why the world works backwards now from what we expect. And all of the sustainability movement and the schools, the government now are saying, promote efficiency, reduce energy consumption. And it seems logical, but it's reducing energy consumption for the person doing the thing and increasing the productivity of the environment you're doing it for. So we're using it with the idea that we're going to prevent climate change by reducing energy consumption with efficiency, and it's the focus of most funded scientific research. That's where the big money is in creating new efficiencies for everything. But does it do that? Because all our impacts are continually growing. Does this work? We're doing the right thing, but are we just acting on old cultural assumptions? Are some of our old solutions maybe causing the problems? I mean, we obviously got here somehow with all this trouble. Are we just, with all this rapid change, are we just suffering from distracted driving? We're just making sudden reactions like Dad talked about. Are we putting out our arms this way and that way and really just reacting chaotically to that situation where we're really supposed to reverse our thought process in the middle of a learning curve? And of course the equation is going to tell us that. The equation is the same equation before and after the inflection point, but the system is not. A learning system is a totally different kind of process. Anyway, so, and then could it be that all the energy codes are just making the growth system more efficient? And multiplying our energy use, and that is what seems to be happening. This is the world of recorded energy use and energy productivity or efficiency, whichever you want to think of it as the work it takes or the service it provides. It's efficiency if you're talking about the work it takes. The same curve as productivity if you're talking about the service it provides. The sustainability movement assumes that the energy goes down like that when productivity goes up. But in fact, the productivity goes up and the energy use goes up as part of the same system. They're parallel. So that's the question. I'm feel pretty comfortable with this group being able to handle new ideas and complicated subjects, but I basically want to just mention a few concrete observables that suggest difficult questions for people to think over rather than convince anybody of anything. And growth systems tend to work as a whole. Your body works as a whole. A business works as a whole, or it doesn't work. I mean, the parts within it aren't responsive to each other and covering each other's shortcomings and taking advantage of each other's surpluses. It's not really a system. That's what a system is. I call it the ESP, or that systems, the parts have a relationship that is, wait a minute, what does ESP stand for? That's the joke that no one might work for. Equal stress principle, that they equalize the stresses within the group, like a family equalizes the stresses within the family. A work group or a school, is a group of people all with different jobs that equalize, they cover for each other. So a system when it grows is growing as a whole. And then the other kind of growth, with a system that is maturing or stabilizing, also grows as a whole, but it's different. It's a different formula. So our economy is operated, the financial system, all the government's plans for the future are operated to follow this. And growing scale is also what we're noticing is the problem. But we have this formula. So, and when you're growing in scale, and this is just throwing out some things that I observed, that you're starting up ever more unfinished things. Like when you're starting a project at work, you start adding new pieces to the puzzle, and then you end that by completing them, making them sustainable, and that's when you get paid. You don't get paid if you don't finish the job, if you don't complete the design. Otherwise, if you just multiply choices for what you're going to do and run out of time, then things are not completed and get left undone. And I think that's basically, my interpretation of what the potential for collapse is. It's just leaving our development system undone and having to let it fall apart because it isn't made complete and in its relationship. Anyway, the resource use map that I use is that there's an earth of resources. Somebody discovers some use for some part of it and has a process that does tool making and builds bigger tools to accelerate the process and so taking a share of the energy and feeding back to bigger tools for obtaining more energy is part of the growth process. And then there are all these variables that get connected, and I have a whole system EROI model that includes this development process and the learning that occurs at the point where environmental conditions change. I haven't put numbers to it yet, but it's a conceptual map that you can get to. I have a couple of links on this that you can get to. But the basic thing in time is you have a seed resource or venture capital, as you like it, or for an organism, it's your mother. That's a seed resource. You leave it unscathed, hopefully. But you get your start up there, and then you continue your growth and maturation, perhaps, or perhaps not. This is responsive growth is what happens. If a system goes through its exponential growth process and then responds to the change in environment and stabilizes and matures and comes to a point of low conflict and climax development. And this is the diagram I started with. When I first started thinking about this in 1979, I wrote a paper called The Intimate Society, and this is from that, seeing the different sectors of a technology economy all going through these breakthroughs of creating new resources by being ingenious, discovering new values to do with things. And remember that first graph, which we'll come to again in more detail, the productivity of using energy was continually growing exponentially. But my version of Jackson and George's curve is that you get to a point where the learning process requires you to make such radical changes that the learning capacity of the people in this case, of the metabolism of the organism or whatever, that you approach a learning impasse where large changes have to occur so fast that you don't get to complete them, and unless you learn the trick and that lets you finance anyway. So and let's see, the learning processes involve search, experiment, and time to solidify. And our cultural image though is of this thing of ever more rapidly accelerating and expanding change as a constant. And this is, to me, one of the most wonderful clues to how we got here, is that our minds are seeing the world as what's in our minds. That it's this, our personal experience isn't changing, it isn't doubling every 20 years, but just our projections, we think in terms of projections, but the physical system has to go through these exploding processes. And they change. and our image of it may not change at all. I mean, it's easy to paint the face of Barack Obama on an electron. It's easy, you can just imagine it very easily. Electron's a little ball, you put his face on that. But physically, it's not possible. The mind, it's very easy for minds to do things that the physical world can't. As well as the reverse. But anyway, so I come down to the question, is this an evolving process of learning, or is it an equation following rules? And I obviously come to a very strong belief that these systems are evolutionary learning processes that are more like an organism than they are like neoclassical economic equation. So here's that curve in detail, where you see that there's there's interesting either wave or bumps that sort of correspond to recession, but also that the productivity increases are faster when the energy increases are slower. And that GDP is the combination of these two. GDP is the product of the energy and the energy productivity. Very simple. It takes GDP as a little productivity and a lot of energy, or GDP growth, let's say.
So your productivity is efficiency?
It is efficiency. It's the same thing. It's exactly the same thing, except the efficiency is what you're talking about, the process doing it, and the productivity is when you're talking about the service it provides. Your employer talks about your productivity as how much more money they are going to make. I mean, that's how it's defined. And you're thinking of it as accomplishing more in a day's work for a little less effort and getting to do it better, or maybe get paid more or something. One of the key things is these curves are really remarkably smooth for a global system. If this was a statistical aggregate of the bumpy curves, that I forget who it was that showed them here, of all the different countries having their
aging.
Well, if this was the statistical aggregate of them, these would still be bumpy curves. Yeah, this is the IEA data, not the EIA, the IEA data. And so this is the best global, this is the OECD's mothership data bank in Paris. And this is, the fact that these two curves are so smooth and have such parallel progression to me clearly says that we have a global system that is efficiently allocating stress to equalize pressures on the system as it's going through this learning process. How efficiency spread their effects. I mean, an efficiency relieves the strain on one thing, in the business, for example, it lets it do produce products that are cheaper, and that it expands its markets and its profits, and then allows it to do other things. It's a growth a stimulus for a business. If you have water conservation in an arid climate, say in Arizona, it lets the developer build that many more homes. So for a little water conservation, you might get twice the urban impact of a development. So it has that kind of a cascading effect. Now all these effects, they go down a tree of consequences for other things, and by and large, the way this has been described by the economists or other scientists has been that they're dissipating trees. But the most important reason why everybody thinks of them as dissipating is the data disappears. You go down a couple steps on the tree and you can't find anything because it's become so diffused. But there's a way to get around that. And actually, that's not in today's talk. If you look at the global metrics, sometimes you can get around that. Anyway, let me just. Or even saving old growth forests, a silence is the squeaking wheel. If it silences the activist groups in the neighborhood, it makes you seem to be relieving the impacts of the environmental strains of the development, but actually just takes the canary out of the coal mine. Yeah?
Do you think that, in a way, that was more than
No. No, I think that if we start learning about this reversal in thinking that occurs in natural systems as they go from the explosive growth learning process to the maturation process, then we can voluntarily see how to change the path. I think a lot of organisms go right up to the edge the way we are, actually, like in birth, that birth happens at the last possible moment. You know, you leave the comfort of using your seed resource at the last possible moment. And a little seedling, it uses the entire little grain of starch, and if it grew up any skinnier and thinner, it would fall over. It goes right to the edge and then starts building itself in a little tiny, an oak tree ends its exponential growth and has its first two little leaves and has considerable life thereafter. So, that's more of the kind of take home message I'm trying to convey. And part of it has to do with, saving money. If you efficiency itself directly creates wealth if it saves money. If you cut your air conditioning bill, you have money to spend. That was printed out of your ingenious way of solving the technology problem of staying cool. So that is the physical system equivalent of printing money, not very naturally limited. It's limited by your learning capabilities. And money saved, of course, is money spent somewhere else, because money is a closed system. It's not something that disappears when you use it. It turns up in someone else's pocket. Or if you don't spend it on something else, it's invested to multiply businesses. And to multiply businesses the way the market selects things to be the most efficient in growing faster and the most efficient in using up our current available affordable resources as fast as possible. So, Gail yesterday responded, yes, take your foot off the gas. That's the first thing. We have this accelerator, and we have a built-in accelerator for making our problems worse. And I think efficiency is one of the main things doing it. And our belief that we're slowing the process down by being more efficient actually means that we're speeding it up. And so it's like maybe getting hit with a punch, perhaps, or maybe the punch won't happen for a few days. I don't know. It's hard to tell. Stopping to think is not the worst thing when you find out that something is not going the way we planned. There's Jevons' paradox, which is that lowering the demand on a commodity lowers its price and makes more available for others to use, and so that part of the savings of an efficiency gets reabsorbed. And what I'm talking about is how the savings of one thing multiplies the uses of completely other things. But we take more discussion of specific examples to probably go through that, and maybe some good questions will come up. Anyway, the economic multiplier is usually that if you add spending in one place, it cascades down into other places and stimulates other spending, similar to Jevons' paradox. Then there's the microeconomic multiplier that I already discussed, how businesses use efficiency. to increase their markets and increase their sales and build themselves. And then, of course, each business copies each other's efficiencies to try to grow faster than the next guy. So they're all hotly competing for improving efficiency as a competitive strategy, and have all along. And so this is really beginning to say, well, why don't we know about this? And of course, the truth is that the neoclassical economists, this is the core of neoclassical economics, is use efficiencies to stimulate growth. But the sustainability movement picked on the exact same solution to have the reverse effect. But the problem with chasing these cascades of effects, and one of the reasons that we get lost in it, is that they're imagined as tailing off, but many of them have fat tails. But there's stuff down here that really adds up big time. And it's off the page. It's beyond our information. So you have to use other kinds of environmental measures to recapture what information you should have been counting. Okay, so apparently without thinking, a new generation invented a new theory.
Yes, this is where?
Right? Oh, yeah, there it is. They seemed to ignore current economic theory that efficiency stimulates growth without increasing consumption. They promoted efficiency as a moral principle because we all believe in it. It's easy to explain. It's also profitable. That should have been a clue that there was nothing wrong. They thought that the local effects would add up to total effects. In other words, that there'd be a linear relationship between efficiencies that one person causes and the reduction of the impact of the system as a whole, which, of course, is completely wrong. They use a linear model for the feedback. I guess my battery's done. There isn't another one?
No, I guess not.
So they use the linear model for the feedback. So I equals PAT, which everybody talks about, is the proof that improving technology lowers impacts. Overlooking the minor detail that population times affluence times technology is a complex system equation in which population and affluence are functions of technology. So, that makes a problem for reducing impacts by reducing technology impacts. Actually multiplies affluence and population so much that you multiply impacts. They didn't check the effect, basically. They used a rationale based on a moral principle that we all like. Just intuitively understand that self-restraint is needed in a sustainable world, and there's nothing wrong with that principle. It's just self-restraint of the system is needed and not the individuals. The individuals, if they're being more productive, they're going to stimulate the system to expand. So we multiplied the problem instead of the solution by not restraining the right thing. And just some fictional graphs. I don't use equations. I just draw them. But if energy use was going to decline like that, and we're going to continue growth, then you need productivity to go like that. And what we really want to do is have energy use decline and productivity stabilize at some level. And so that means switching the thought process here. That's the I equals PAT. How we got here is by being confused. Both neoclassical and sustainability theory explain how to reduce our impact in ways that increase them faster. Neoclassical by saying the more money you make, the more money you have to pay for the impact of the old money you made. and sustainability theorists by saying the less impact you have on the environment, the less impact we all have on the environment, which is the opposite. Correct. And they seem to agree, so what effect our choices leave unseen opportunities for other things, things that we're missing. Today's average impact is 6,000 BTUs a dollar, and if you count up your energy uses and compare it to 6,000 BTUs times the dollars you use, they're likely to be quite different. And so this is a searching tool for finding where your impacts really are. And if you're assuming that this is going to double all the time, that is a clue to what your physical impact on your environment is. It's also 0.34 kilograms, 12 ounces of carbon for every dollar we spend. If I buy a $5 beer, I end up with 60 ounces of carbon for one beer.
Carbon dioxide in beer.
Yeah, right. No. The carbon dioxide in beer is something I find flavorful. But no, putting a 3 or 4 times the weight of the beverage I drink in carbon, which is a gas, but huge volumes of this gas into the atmosphere for 200-300 years.
That would be for the children.
What for what? The chili?
Yes,
well, the chili, I don't know. I think that, what value of chili did I eat?
We've already used it to make it, and then we make it and we process it in the double whammy.
Well, you have to, with these methods, you have to look at double counting possibilities. But anyway, so in the investment cycle, what any new opportunities we get will be used for. That's the trick. What's the environment going to do with what we leave untended? Because nature works. Nature has an amazing computer algorithm. It's garbage in, music out. She does the opposite of what our machines do. I mean, our machines have to have everything pre-programmed, figured out, but she just improvises. And so what is nature going to improvise on what you're doing? And that's by understanding what system you're in. If you're in whether it's one kind of group or another, you can judge the experience of the process around you and how your environment is changing by whether it's developing by bigger and bigger steps or whether it's discovering things that it needs to integrate with and mature. And then, of course, the steering thing. The steering of both of these curves is with the surpluses that this process has. It's the investment returns that go then to build new factories. They are what decide what factory to build. And it's the same with your own projects. You get a response from one group of people, and you may reinvest that response in the same group of people or in another group of people. You make choices with your returns on investment in your career, in your business, in the economy, and so understanding how that works. And then, of course, the thing that everybody talks about here that nobody talks about anywhere else is how this process is consuming the last remaining cheap resources that we need to use to learn how to rely on expensive resources. And so we have a window of opportunity, and it's shrinking rapidly. And let me see if... getting people curious about this subject is the main thing. I would like to see in the science to see growth systems and their experience histories written up in detail and use that to connect the natural evolutionary processes with the languages of all the different disciplines, since all the disciplines have different languages. And then the problem is the true currency of learning systems that go through this change is not at all consistent with what people want. So figuring out how to make money out of this is, yeah. Okay. So, what else could we be productive in? And that's maturation. I have various other slides that I could go through, examples of enduring economies, of responsive self-investment systems. Systems that begin by self-investment, but then are responsive to themselves and their environment at the change point in their growth. And then a mathematical model that shows that if you start with this kind of trajectory, and at a certain point you simply unplug the self-investment loop. The system naturally does that. You know, so you have this little tiny growth curve and this huge sweeping climax curve. Or you unplug the system and it does that. So those are the kinds of evolutionary choices that occur at the inflection point. And of course, I'll never work again, Mickey says. And his reaction, however, when he discovers that there was a problem, is to, you know, to chop up the broom, you know, chop up all the magic. And there's a film, a new animation coming out in January. So The Sorcerer's Apprentice, and I think it would be good to have people think about what that really means. What experience in life is this? All fables are about experiences in life. And this is a fable about a very, very particular system phenomenon that we are immersed in. And natural language is full of important learning tools and insights into these complex systems, learning processes. And then my model for explaining some of this, how to build lasting systems, or like one of my illustrations, and then the technicalities of this closed loop ownership model, where we continually multiply ownership over on the financial side, and we try to make up wealth on the physical side, and what actually would have to change in order to stabilize things. And thank you for letting me get to the end of this. There's also some you know, deeper questions about, you know, our thought process and our environment, what we're doing. Okay.
I wonder if I might have 2 minutes. Thank you. That was really good. And I'm glad I invited Phil. Something with messages with Phil on email is like drinking from a fire hose. And it's really nice to see it distilled. And when we get this material, you realize this is what I try to teach my freshmen in the first lecture. And where I say, I talk to them and I say, the field is analysis in Sweden, where people got together with nutritionists and environmentalists and tried to come up with an environmentally friendly diet so that you would have oatmeal instead of sausages for breakfast and so forth and so on. And it was done to try to reduce carbon release. And they found in fact that they did reduce carbon release, people who ate this diet, but she also found by interviewing people, many Swedes would follow this diet, and when they followed this diet, that they had saved 15% carbon and 18% of their money or whatever it was, all the same, but that they would then take the money that they saved and would take more vacations. And when they would take more vacations, they would do something more energy intensity, even more energy intense, with their money that they saved. And the net effect was they reduced. The people who follow this diet produce more CO2. So sometimes people say, you know, I get in my car and go fishing, and I think, well, maybe that's a kind of a foolish use of
fossil fuel, and I think, well, if I don't use this oil, some Chinese guy's coming in. So can we, is there any constraints? Still seems to think there's voluntary or learning constraints. I personally don't think there's going to be any constraints until it's physical.
Because the opportunities and constraints have different effects.
Yep. And it is definitely an opportunity, but I think, well, I don't know where we're going with this, and that might be a topic we would discuss. Because certainly this college is all about improving efficiency. And if that's what, if you say, and if I agree, if you say and I agree that improving efficiency needs to, you say, not only Gevon's paradox, but more, a multiplied Gevon's paradox.
Well, that's what the world is doing. Are we different from the world?
Where do we go? Okay, that's a topic, perhaps, an introductory topic for our panel. Thank you very much, Jim.
Thank you.